You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
So what made you write a novel? I mean, right? People should know, writing a novel is not an easy thing. Like, you have to sit in front of a keyboard for a year or so, and you know, I always feel like, and I write a lot, but humans aren't really made to like just hit keys all day long.
Well, tell that to Stephen King, and tell that to, you know, James Michener, who wrote like every novel was 900 pages. But what made me write a novel? I just another way to express myself, as you're saying, multiple income streams, multiple, you know, just trying to try everything. Now, I could have written another screenplay, and I've written those, but problem with the screenplay is if nobody wants to produce it, you don't have anything. But a novel, you have something. You can sell it. People can see it. You have a finished product. And a screenplay is not a finished product. Somebody's got to invest $1 million or whatever it is into making it. And now I could have written a memoir, but a lot of comedians have written memoirs. And I just wanted to do something that hasn't been done quite as often.
What about something like what Jim Gaffigan or Jerry Seinfeld do, which is they basically write their jokes in book form? You can see in let's say Jim Gaffigan's book Food, like every line is a joke, every sentence has a punchline, and of course
I think that's great for famous comedians to do, and they have a following that's going to buy their books. But for me, I don't think anyone's going to buy a book from a comedian that they don't know. That's basically their act or their memoir. So I figure a novel, if it, you know, I mean, you don't have to be famous for people to buy your novel, because I mean, most novels don't sell that much, but theoretically it could, you know.
The average novel sells 300 copies.
Right, yeah. But the average memoir of a non-famous person probably sells even less.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I will say, like, stylistically, you made some really interesting choices, I felt. Like, first off, you go back and forth between normal third person omniscient, first person, and then there's the structural aspect of telling the story, but also going back and forth with the memoir, which normally I would say that particular part doesn't, in other novels, I've seen that not work so well, but with yours, it really worked well because it always, the memoir chapters were flowing with what was happening in the story. So it was just a different way of continuing the story, which I thought was very good. Like, I thought stylistically, it was a very kind of mature written book. Like, how long did it take you to write it?
I started before the pandemic, and it's called Ira Spiro Before COVID. So you would have thought that I wrote it with the pandemic in mind, but I really didn't. I started writing it before the pandemic and finished it during the pandemic, probably about a year and a half total writing. And then there was editing and all that. So maybe 2 years from beginning to end. But I started writing it before the pandemic, not knowing how it was going to end. And the pandemic came along and I said, well, I can't ignore the, because it took place in the present. It takes place like from the recent past up to the present. So I said, well, the pandemic is so big. I called my friend Nurit Koppel, who's a writer and an actress. And I said, do you think I can ignore the pandemic? You know, if it takes place? And she said, no, maybe you can end it with the pandemic. And so I took her advice and I ended it as the pandemic is beginning. And the whole time I was struggling to find, what am I going to call this thing? The pandemic came along and then I found my title, Ira Spiro Before COVID.
I also like, though, the title mentioned in the book, Ira Spiro Superhero. I thought it was funny, although you repeatedly say in the, your main character, Ira, in the book, repeatedly says he doesn't like that title.
Well, his friend, his fellow comedian says, Ira Hero Superhero, Ira Spiro Superhero. That's sort of her nickname for him, and he doesn't really like it, but just one of the characters that calls him that.
Why doesn't he like it?
Well, I don't know if he hates it. I just, he thinks it's stupid, I guess. I don't know.
And you also made the decision, which I agree with, to self-publish. I think everybody should self-publish. I think going through a traditional publisher where you have to wait year, A, you have to get chosen, and that's a grueling process. And then B, you have to wait years before it actually comes out, years after you write it. So I think it's smart to self-publish. But why did you choose that?
Well,
route?
For the reasons you said. I mean, I didn't feel like waiting, say, a year, 2 years, 3 years to find a, first you got to get an agent, then you got to get a publisher. And this is if all goes well, assuming you can get an agent and assuming they can sell it to a publisher. And then the publisher might take 2 years to publish it. So for those reasons that you just articulated with the reasons, I guess, impatience, I guess, more than anything else. Also, it was Ira Spiro Before COVID. I want to write it. I want to get it out there whilst COVID is still, I mean, COVID's going to be relevant probably for another 10 years at least. But, you know, it's become an important part of history. So I don't know that it's necessarily going to become stale. However, I did want to get it out there whilst COVID was still a thing, because COVID's in the title and the end of the novel is the beginning of COVID, you know?
Yeah. And you know, by the way, most, I think in general, self-published books do in fact sell more copies on average than mainstream published books. Most people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I would say the median, not the average, but the median, which is more important. Because, you know, like Harry Potter will sell a billion copies, you know, but like five books in mainstream published will sell, you know, a million copies. But there are a lot of self-published books that do well among their niche fan bases and can sell a million copies.
In part because people that self-publish are often know that they have a fan base or a means to promote them. But like, I wouldn't have self-published if I didn't have access to an audience literally every night of the week and to say, Dan Natterman, he buys book on Amazon. You know, if I couldn't hand out cards to people in the audience that came up to me and said, we love your comedy, if I couldn't come on shows like this, then I probably wouldn't have self-published because I'd know that I had no means of promotion, because promotion is so important. But because I can do those things and I can go to shows and promote the book and go on podcasts and promote the book and maybe get on Fallon or Corden or Colbert and promote the book. So I made the decision with those things in mind. So I think a lot of people that self-publish, they self-publish because they know they can promote it.
Yeah, and also you have more tools to promote it. So like let's say, so I go back and forth, but let's say I self-publish a book. I can make a deal with someone who has a large audience and say, look, if I do this, 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 like add extra chapters or throw in something else, will you promote this to your email list and I give you a cut? Like, I'm able to make business decisions around the book if I self-publish, as opposed to if I publish with, like, you know, a Random House. You can't really make deals about
right, and that's in your where, and that's your wheelhouse. I mean, in your case, your business is your wheelhouse more so than mine. So you know that the fact that you get to control your own promotion is good for somebody like you who does that. You know, that's something that you're good at.
When did it come out, or when's it coming out? I mean, I have a copy.
It's out. It's out on Amazon and also BarnesandNoble.com, but mainly it's on Amazon. Ira Spiro Before COVID. Just you can search for it on Amazon, and you can also read 3 or 4 sample chapters on Kindle if you want.
And during so obviously some of this you were writing during the lockdowns last year and so on, but during the lockdowns, and I know I see in the book Ira Spiro does at least one Zoom comedy session. But what were you doing during COVID? Where'd you go? Did you stay in New York?
I was mostly in New York. I did go to Aruba a couple of times, you know, Aruba Ray. I don't know if you know Ray.
Yeah, I know.
He produces shows down there. So I did that. And you had to get tested to get in and had to get tested to get out. But other than that, once you're in Aruba, it's pretty good because it's the weather is so good that you could be outside all the time.
And you were performing there?
Yeah, we were performing there. So, but during the day you're outside and unlike in New York at the time, because I was there during the winter, the restaurants were closed because they didn't want anybody inside, or if they were open, I don't know, they were distancing. But in Aruba, everything's warm weather, so you can always go to dinner. You can go to a bar that's outside.
I think that's why so many people moved south during this period, is because most of those states were a bit more open than New York. New York was almost draconian in its keeping people indoor, you know, keeping people out of stores and restaurants and shutting everything down. You know, I don't know if you remember, but Stand Up New York even like sued the state of New York to open up because they weren't opening up. They were opening up other places, but not comedy clubs. How's Nome doing? How's the Comedy Cellar?
The Comedy Cellar is pretty much back, you know. But first of all, it's completely open and without restrictions, but you do have to present a vaccine card at the door. But once you're in, the seats are close together and everything is as it was. The only thing is that because there's less tourists in New York, so there maybe isn't always full every show. Maybe it's full half the shows and the other half are 90% full. It's not 100% back to where it was, but it's mostly back to where it was. And and the Vegas room, there's a Comedy Cellar in Vegas, and that's back open, but I'm not sure if it's at 100% capacity or not. And they're using a lot of local acts.
What if, like I just had COVID, so I'm not supposed to take a vaccine for the next 90 days, something like that. I don't know. Each doctor says something different. So I can't go to New York City right now because I can't go anyplace.
Well, no, the cellar will let you in with a negative test, I think. I think if you have a negative test, you can get into the Comedy Cellar too, or a vaccine, one or the other. But I'm not exactly sure.
I was supposed to speak at some conference and instead, now they are requiring me to do Zoom because of the vaccine mandate.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's like, wow.
I didn't know. First of all, I didn't know that if you had COVID, you couldn't get vaccinated right away. I didn't realize that. You would think there would be some sort of exemption for, because you have the antibodies, right? Isn't that just as good?
Yeah.
Or even
it's
better?
Yeah, if it's at least for the next 90 days, it's better.
Well, I assume that, I know that Nome allows people in. Oh, then again, there's a new rule out in New York that you had to be Nome was doing it anyway. He was asking for vaccine cards before the mandate in New York. But now that there's a mandate in New York, I don't know if that's changed things. I'm not sure.
Nome must really hate this mandate stuff. That this is not Nome style.
He doesn't mind look, he'd rather there not be COVID to begin with.
Sure.
But given that there is COVID, no, he doesn't mind. He doesn't mind. Given that COVID exists, which again he'd rather it didn't.
So what's the next step?
I also just to finish your question about what I was doing in the pandemic, I also started learning guitar, but then after 6 months I gave up. Like I was really going at it pretty hard, and then after six months all of a sudden I said, I don't feel like doing this anymore, and I just stopped playing. Maybe I'll get back to it. I don't know.
I think a lot of people felt the urge to like learn something new, and you know, YouTube, they would watch instructional YouTube videos.
I was like learning on YouTube. Yeah.
I felt like playing the piano during COVID, but I never really pursued it.
You know, to get really, really good, it takes so much time. And if I say, you know, maybe I'll just watch videos of people that play well and sing along instead of learning how to do it myself. I was having a lot of fun with it, but then it's all of a sudden just, you know, I stopped wanting to do it. I don't know why. I can't quite explain it.
I think it's easy to lose passion for things. Like, you know, you do something for 6 months, and then if you're not making, I think progress fuels passion. So if you're making progress, you feel more passionate because you see results. But if your progress is not as good as you would like it to be, it's very easy to lose passion.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's what separates, you know, the great. I was talking about this with Noam, who is a musician, and he was saying that the people that are, you know, the brilliant musicians, they had natural talent, because if they didn't, they wouldn't have pursued it. Like, in other words, it's hard work, but you have to have enough talent such that you're progressing, as you said, because if you weren't, you wouldn't commit 5 hours a day. Like, you know, like Jimi Hendrix, they say, used to go to the bathroom with his guitar because he just always wanted to be playing. But I think he had to have enough natural talent such that he was making enough progress to inspire that level of dedication.
Right. Well, I think it all feeds each other, because obviously talent isn't the full story. There's probably no professional, anybody of anything, who thrives on just talent. It's like 1% talent, 99%, you know, working the skills. Like, you have to, Jimi Hendrix had some talent, but he still brought the guitar to the bathroom all day long. So you need to work at it. But you also need the passion to continue, because you know from comedy, anything worth doing is going to suck for a really long time. And even 20 years into it, you're probably it still occasionally sucks. Like, it's not like, if you play tennis, sometimes you're going to lose. If you play the guitar, sometimes you're not going to do it as well as you like, even if you're, you know, the best professional in the world. If you're a comedian, no matter how long you've been doing it, sometimes you're going to just bomb.
Yeah.
And it's not about like, I've never heard someone say about comedy, I'm happy every single time I'm stage. Like, maybe you feel good about yourself that you're good at something and that you're progressing at something, but I don't think difficult things are necessarily happy things. Like, how often are you miserable doing comedy?
Like I said, when I'm doing my out of town at a club, I'm anxious. But when I, in New York, when I'm at the Comedy Cellar or the local clubs, or, you know, Stand Up New York or West Side, whatever club it is, I'm usually enjoying it, you know. But yes, sometimes you don't. Sometimes they're not laughing. Sometimes you're not doing well. And so that does happen, you know. But it doesn't affect my self-esteem. It affects my enjoyment, but not my self-esteem, because I know that this is an outlier. I know, well, usually it works, and this time it's not working. So I don't say to myself, I stink, because I know that the 9 out of 10 or 99 of 100 performances are good.
What about when you were first starting, like your first couple of years? Your batting average was probably a little bit lower.
Yeah, but
your self-esteem then?
You know, oddly enough, I don't remember. I think I just had lower standards, so that if they were kind of laughing a little bit, I would say, oh my God, I'm making people laugh. And I didn't realize that the laughter was at a low level. I think I was deluded. I think I was sufficiently delusional, and it carried me. And then as you get better, you insist on just light laughs are no longer sufficient. You need roars. You need explosions to get the same level of satisfaction.
And obviously you're getting that now?
Well, frequently, you know, depending on where you're at. And some audiences, they don't explode. You know, if you're performing for an older crew, say, at a synagogue fundraiser or something like that, then you may not get the same explosiveness that you get at the Comedy Cellar on a Saturday night. But you adjust, you know.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like, I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a three-year period, and I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs, and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, of course, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like, I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away, and I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a three-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
Have you ever heard of a Dunning-Kruger bias?
Yeah, I have heard of that. Yeah, I have heard. I just don't know what it is, but I've heard of it.
It's a cognitive bias that makes you think that you're better than you are. So for instance, 9 out of 10 Americans think they're an above average driver, mm-hmm. which is impossible. Like, only right. 4 out of 10 are above average, but 9 out of 10 think there are. And people usually say Dunning-Kruger's is a bad thing because it's your brain lying to you. Oh, it's telling you you're great at something when you're not really great. But I actually find Dunning-Kruger bias to be incredibly valuable because it keeps you in the driver's seat trying to get better at something longer than you would have if you realized that you sucked. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, in the beginning of doing something, you keep going because you think you're great. Only later you realize, oh, right. I wasn't great then. I sucked.
I hear it all the time. Comics will say, I cannot believe, you know, I'm embarrassed that, you know, the my first special or my first Letterman or my first Conan, I look at them like, oh my God, this is horrible. But none of us thought it was horrible at the time. So it's exactly what you're saying, you know? Plus our standards get higher, you know, it probably wasn't that horrible, but it was definitely not that good. You know, my first TV appearance, for example, but I thought it was the greatest thing ever. You know, I mean, my first time on stage, it was in front of my friends, but they were laughing. And I said, well, I thought I was great because I was getting laughs, even though it was people I knew.
Well, and you know, when you were on America's Got Talent in 2014, and you're hilarious. I forgot, how high did you go?
I was in the semifinals or whatever. I guess it was the semifinals, I think.
Is that the most a comedian's done in America's
Got
Talent?
No, Tom Cotter went to, he finished second place, and Josh Blue right now is like in the top five or something. So, no, people have gotten, no comedian's ever won America's Got Talent. And I really don't think America's Got Talent is a good venue for stand-up comedy.
It's more about music.
Music and dancing and anything that have a kind of mass appeal. Comedy is very, I mean, I made this point backstage when I was doing America's Got Talent. I said, you know, if Celine Dion or any of the top singers, you know, who are the best singers in the world, whatever, I don't know, you know, Whitney Houston, but when she was around, if they had come on America's Got Talent, they'd have crushed it. You know, the best dancers, the best musicians, the best singers in the world, if they did America's Got Talent, would crush it. But would Would Louis C.K. crush America's Got Talent? I don't think necessarily he would. First of all, many of his jokes, the network would say you can't do it. And, you know, the ones he did.
Oh, did you have to run your jokes by the network before you performed
them?
Yes,
they tell you, no, you can't do that, can't do that, can't do that. This is too controversial. This is, you know, politically incorrect. This is, you say a bad word. So you're hamstrung that way. And then on a given night, you know, if an audience might not, I've seen great comedians not do well. You know, Mitch Hedberg used to bomb. You know, I've seen Attell, you know, not do well. So on a given night, you just never know. Whereas if you hit the right notes in a song, I think you kind of, I don't think, they're always going to like that. But a comedian, yeah, you just never know.
It's funny you just said that about the musicians, because again, that's something that Ira in the book talks about, mm-hmm. is like if music has the same effect on the audience as comedy. And I hear your voice in this book all throughout. Like, and the reason I could say you and Ira, the main character, are neurotic is like you're noticing all of these offbeat details about things that I wouldn't normally notice. I think a lot, and I think I'm somewhat neurotic as well. And I hope I'm not insulting you by saying you perhaps are even more. And I could feel that in the character.
No insult taken.
I could feel that in the character because you're
Well, yeah, the character makes the point that a musician, if he's singing a song that the people already love, they're going to like the song. Like, you know, if they're singing a song that's a top 40 hit and they're singing it well, the audience is going to appreciate it. But a comic is doing jokes that they've never heard before. So you just don't know. You know, there's no guarantee that when I come out there with a joke that the audience has never heard, that they're going to like it. But if I come out and I sing a song that's a huge hit song, and if I have to sing it well, obviously, but if I do sing it well, it's pretty much guaranteed it's going to go over.
Yeah, sometimes I always think that is the best job, is being like a great musician. Because you're making everybody happy. You're filling stadiums with like millions of people. And it's just probably a great experience. Like, imagine being like Bono from U2. That guy's performing. He must be feeling so good.
But you know what? I think, and I've always thought that too. Like, how could there be anything better than being on stage singing an amazing song? And yet, my guess is, human nature being what it is that these guys, after a certain time, they're on stage like, oh Christ, how many more songs do I got to do? You know, I just think human nature doesn't allow for that level of happiness at a sustained level, so that by the time Billy Joel's at the 20th show of his tour, he's like, oh Christ, do I have to sing Piano Man again? You know, if you watch the Eagles documentary, there might've been more than one, but there was one where, what's his name? Randy Meisner. They said, you got to sing Take It to the Limit, you know, but that's his song that he sings. And he's like, I don't want to, and I don't think I can hit the high notes, and I'm tired of the song. And Don Henley's like, I'm fucking tired of all these songs too, but you know, I come and I do the songs and you got to do this. So he wasn't thrilled to be singing Take It to the Limit.
And they got to be sick of doing Hotel California, because that's probably the most requested song in all of history.
I assume so, yeah. So, you know, they probably want to do their new, like, you know, these musicians, you know, they probably want to do their new stuff, but they know the audience wants to hear the old stuff.
Well, I think that's what separated out Bob Dylan from a lot of musicians, is that he writes in his memoirs that he knew he could have gone in the stage that that pop music was going, but he just wanted to do his stuff. And, you know, particularly later on in his career, people just didn't like it as much, but he still wanted to do it. He had enough confidence and self-awareness to just keep doing what he wanted to do.
I mean, I suppose if money had been an issue, he might have gone the other way, but he was sufficiently well off, I guess, that he could make that choice, you know. But
are you performing tonight?
Well, tonight is Yom Kippur, and I will be fasting. And I'm not religious. I don't know why I fast. It's just I feel guilty if I don't, and so I won't be performing. No.
Are you supposed to ask me for forgiveness now? Because it's Yom Kippur.
Well, I think I've always been nice to you, but if I haven't, then I do ask.
No, you have. You've always been a
but no, I'm not
a
religious, James. So I don't ask for forgiveness because I don't believe in in that there's somebody up there with a book judging us and writing down will we live this year, will we die this year. But for some reason, I feel the need to do certain things. I just grew up with fasting, you know, at least since I was a teenager. I didn't do it when I was little.
I guess some things feel more cultural than religious. Like you've been doing something all your life and it doesn't really seem to have a religious flavor to it and there's nothing wrong with fasting. I mean, I'm the same way, although I didn't even know it was Yom Kippur tonight until you just told me.
Yeah, well, you're worse than I am. But on the other hand, you, I don't know, you have children, so you were fruitful and multiplied. So you know, you've done, that's which is the highest duty, I think. So you've already done the highest duty, even though your kids aren't Jewish. So maybe you didn't do the highest duty.
I failed as a Jew in many respects. I my kids are not Jewish, and I've gone broke many times. So I'm automatically disqualified from services of all sorts. So Dan Natterman, author of Ira, for some reason I have a hard time saying the name, Ira Spiro.
A lot of people say Shapiro, but it's Spiro.
Ira Spiro, Before COVID, great novel. It's actually the first novel I've read in a while, and I really do think it was a page-turner. I loved not only the comedy stuff and the stuff that reminded me of you, but just a great story, and you have, you know, plots overlaying each other, which is, and just, I think it's very unique how you wrote it, like stylistically. I always like when people take experiments that, but it still doesn't seem experimental. And I think that the style in which you wrote this and the choices you made served the book well. People should get it. It's also just a great novel about the life of a comedian, if nothing else, but it's, again, beyond that, great story, great characters, and so on. So I highly recommend people get it. Thanks so much for coming
on
the show.
Thank you. Good to see you again.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in 2 years, since before COVID. Thanks again, Dan. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.